My castaway this week is a novelist. Her first book, The Beautiful Visit, was published in 1950 and it won the John Llewellyn Rees Memorial Prize. Her latest work is The Cazalet Chronicles, four novels about the life of a family in the 30s and 40s. The 45 years in between have been filled by many other books and three marriages. Peter Scott was her first husband and Kingsley Amis her last. She left them because writing is not the only passion in her life. She yearns for love. The trouble is, she says, falling in love uses the same kind of energy you need for writing, so you can't do both at the same time. She is Elizabeth Jane Howard. So the fact, Jane, that you've produced four volumes of these Cazalet Chronicles over the past 5 years means that you haven't been distracted by the demands of love, does it?
I'm afraid not, no. The nearest I've come to it is my Cavalier Spaniel, which is rather less demanding.
But I don't understand why you can't do both. I mean, surely, why do you have to compartmentalise?
Well, I suppose if one was awfully good at both those things, one would be able to do both. I mean, people like Georges Sand seem to manage it nicely. But I think perhaps I'm not very good at either of these things, and so I'd have to use absolutely all the energy I've got for either of them.
Or is it the case that you can only be intimate with one person or one thing, so it's the husband or the writing?
I think really also I come from a generation, you know, where women are expected to put their hobbies, practices, professions, vocations second to the man in their life. And that dies very hard. I like to think that my granddaughters won't do that. But
so quite simply and in straightforward terms, you're saying you've spent so much time during marriages cooking for people and putting the washing through and whatever like the rest of we ordinary mortals that frankly you didn't have time to do what you love doing, which is right.
Yes, I think there's that, but also, of course, I'm very frightened of writing, so I expect I used a lot of those things as excuses, you know. I mean, it's a very nerve-wracking process. And now I'm sort of faced with being able to do it all the time. I've got slightly better at doing it all the time.
It's gone well, then, for the last 5 years, this writing?
I think I've learned a bit,
which really begs the question, how much do you miss the bit you haven't had, which is the companionship and the love?
Very much. I think one always would miss that, because I don't think people are constituted to live alone, really. I don't think I'm alone in not liking being alone very much. I think you can get much better at it. I think I've got better at it, but I wouldn't choose it.
Well, it's going to be quite a lonely business on a desert island. Tell me about the first piece of music that will keep you sane.
Well, Mozart is, I suppose, my very favourite, most serious composer, and I love the piano concertos, and this E-flat major one is my favourite. It's Kirchhoff 449, and I think Marie Perrin is a wonderful pianist, and so that's a good combination.
Part of Mozart's Concerto No. 14 in E-flat major for piano and orchestra, played by Murray Pariah with the English Chamber Orchestra. Jane, the characters who people your books are therefore your friends and your company, and you've lived with these people for 5 years, the Cazalets. But you've now finished them off. Is there enormous sadness in that?
Yes, 7 years, actually, I've been on them. Yes, there is, because I think one is always sad about leaving people at the end of a novel. And at the end of four novels, of course, you know more about their lives because they've been growing up with you.
But in many ways, you've lived with the Cazalets for much longer than those 7 years, because it's a very autobiographical work, isn't it? There's a lot of you in it.
Yes, the girls are all aspects of me, and then invented aspects, you know.
So does that mean that your life, your early life, your childhood, was as ostensibly idyllic as that, that there were these long, hot summers in the country and raspberries for tea and ponies and gardens and so on?
Yes. I think, on the whole, I did have, I suppose, by many... Most of the time, I had a happy childhood, really.
But your greatest problem, you've confessed before now, was, and I quote, trying to get your parents to care about you more than they did. What did they care about instead?
Well, I think my father cared about me, but he was, of course, you know, working and out all the time, really. I was trying to get my mother to love me, and I don't really think, poor dear, that she did much. And she loved my brothers, and I loved her, and... That was very sort of debilitating.
How situation. Did it manifest itself, though, that dislike?
Putting me down in front of other people a great deal. Not knowing a lot of the time what was going on. I was at a very nasty day school where I was bullied sick, and she had no idea of that. And I feel, in a way, looking back at it, that she should have. I did try very hard with her. I think I just never... measured up in some mysterious way. I don't know. She had a child before me that died, and I think she probably had me much too soon afterwards and didn't want to have a baby.
Was that a girl too?
Another girl called Jane. And I think that, you know, she perhaps didn't want to start another baby so quickly and felt bad about it.
But she loved your brothers who came after
She loved my brothers, yes. They could do no wrong, really. She was the most unloved child in her family. I think it's probably, you know, that role model. I think she was probably behaving to me very much as her mother had behaved to her. And that's how it goes on, doesn't it, till you stop it, till you recognise it.
When did you recognise it? When did you
Well, I don't think I really got over her completely until in the last 10 years, I suppose. I feel I've done a lot of therapy and I've sort of grown up a bit rather belatedly, but I have. And I now do feel very sorry for her. I think I felt very angry with her for a long time because I think she did, in curious ways, sort of bitch up my life, I suppose.
How did she, in fact, have this effect on the rest of your life? What do you think it left you
well,
feeling?
Well, I always felt that everything I did wasn't good enough. I mean, a lot of things I wasn't good at, but I wasn't encouraged very much.
And you weren't much loved?
Well... I can't say I was certainly loved by my father and my brothers. I can't say she wasn't. It's so difficult to say, isn't it? I think you sort of know somewhere inside you if somebody doesn't have the right feelings for you, however hard they try. I think she tried.
Tell me about your second record.
I couldn't think which Brandenburg concerto to have, and then I decided to have the opening of number 5 simply because, in a way, I'm not sure that it's the first one I ever heard in my life, but it is the one which reminds me of all the others, and I feel on an island I'll need that.
Thank you. opening of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 5 in D major, played by the Adolf Busch Chamber Players, conducted by Adolf Busch. Tell me about being educated at home in London in the 30s.
Well, it was not even in then, those days, it wasn't a very usual education. I had the governess who had taught my mother, and she seemed amazingly old to me, and my mother said that she'd always seemed old to her as well. But she was the most astonishing woman. She was nearly blind and remarkably ugly and very gentle and very intelligent. And she would have taught me Greek much more than and Latin, but I wasn't very good at them. But she let me read Shakespeare for an hour and a half every day aloud, which is what I wanted to do. I mean, she was quite right to do that, but a lot of people wouldn't have. You know.
So there were advantages in that sense to being taught at home?
I loved it. I thought it was marvellous. And also, by then, I was terrified of my contemporaries. And I started alone with her, and then eventually two girls joined us and a boy called Johnny Craxton, who was a painter now. And he joined us having been expelled, I think he said, from 8 schools. The last one for biting the matron, because she tried to scrape his chicken pox spots with a knife. And I think he was completely justified. But
quite.
But by God, he managed all of us with no difficulty at all.
So there were some advantages, but what about through the rest of your life? Have you found suddenly great yawning gaps in your knowledge?
Frightful gaps. Mm. I mean, when I was sort of discharged from her, aged 16, and when I began falling in love with people, I mean, everybody I fell in love with made me sort of earnest reading lists, you know, and I, of course, never caught up with them because I fell in love with someone else, you know, before
got
I read
list.
The 10 books. And I think they must, to this day, be incomplete.
Why, that would be because they couldn't believe you hadn't read whatever it was, The Riddle of the Sands.
They were quite shocked, and they were all better educated. I mean, almost everybody is better educated than me. I just know a few different things, I suppose.
Is that not your inferiority complex coming out again?
No, I think I don't feel educated. I really don't.
You talked about your mother, but what about your father? In the books, the girls, all of them, all three of them, have rather intense relationships with their fathers, almost
yes.
romantic ones, actually.
Yes. Well, my father was a very sort of attractive, romantic-looking man, and he was very fond of me. I mean, I think probably I was his favourite, and the boys were my mother's, but I didn't see an awful lot of him in my early years.
But was he like Edward Caslett? Was he a bit of a philanderer?
Oh, yes, he certainly was, yes, yes. I mean, my parents really were very ill-matched. There's no question. I knew that from a very early age.
And he left her in the end, did he?
He left her in the end. He got, as it were, almost trapped by somebody, I think, like philanderers inevitably do. And I don't know that it made him happy. I think not, in the long run.
Next record.
The next record is... I'm having this because not only because I love Chopin, but particularly because I love the playing of my oldest friend, Nina Milkina, whom I've known since I was 14, and I met her when she was playing to my grandfather, who was a composer, when he was dying. And we became friends, and we've been friends ever since, and she is a very remarkable pianist, I think.
Chopin's Mazurka in B major, Opus 41, number 3, played by Nina Milkina. You were 16, Jane, when the war broke out. Did that mean the end of childhood for you in many ways?
Yes, very much, I think. And it was something that I had been dreading for ages, all my childhood, really. I started dreading war because I saw this faded photograph on my father's dressing table of men in very baggy uniform. And I said, who are they? And he said, they were my friends. And I said, where are they now? And he said, they're all dead except me. And this was so shocking to me. He then explained that they'd died in the war. As I started reading books about the First World War, and the more I read about it, the more terrifying war seemed to me to be.
You decided by that time to become an actress, hadn't you?
And yes,
you...
That was a very early decision. Yes. When I was 16, I went to a cooking school because I was so frightfully homesick. And I realised you couldn't be a world-famous actress and not be able to go out to lunch, even, let alone stay anywhere. So I got myself sent to a cooking school.
But all that fear of being away from home and of being a grown-up, if you like, and yet by 1942, at the age of 19, you got married. You married Peter Scott, the artist and naturalist. Well, was that the war that made it happen so quickly?
I think the war is what made it happen so quickly. And I don't even know, looking back on it, whether it would have happened at all if there hadn't been a war. I met him when I was 16, and I married him when I was just 19. And, of course, we'd spent remarkably little time together because he was in the Navy.
But how did you spend that time? Did he whisk you off to clubs and smart places?
He whisked me off. He took me dancing, which he was extremely good at and I wasn't. He took me to the theatre, which, of course, I adored. And he drew me endlessly, which, of course, is tremendously flattering when you're that age, particularly if you felt, which I did, that you were rather plain. And...
You fell in love?
We fell in love, yes.
Or thought you did.
Or thought we did. You see, it's so difficult to know that, isn't it, really? I mean, certainly we thought we were. And certainly in the back of the whole thing was the idea that he was going to be killed. You know, every time I said goodbye to him, I thought, well, you know, I don't know if I'll see him again.
So it was romantic in the beginning, and then it obviously continued to be really rather dramatic.
Yes, it was hard, I think. I'm sure it was hard for him, too, having somebody so young who was... I was terribly homesick when I got married, of course. I don't think I was at all a good wife at any point.
Did you know anything about sex before then?
Jolly little, actually. I remember my mother asked me if I knew about the nasty side of married life about 2 days before I got married, and I quickly said yes, because I really didn't want her to talk about it.
And did you?
I did, because by then I had actually been to bed with him.
So he taught you about the nasty
side? He taught me about the nasty side of married life.
And did you object to the word nasty then?
Oh, yes, I thought that was... I mean, that was just how my mother and her mother talked about those sort of things, if indeed they ever discussed them. And my grandmother was the kind of person who couldn't be seen going to or coming from a lavatory. That does complicate life, yes. Those sort of inhibitions.
So when did reality hit you? Was there a moment, do you recall, when you thought, my God, what am I doing
yes,
here?
Yes, I think it hit me pretty soon, really. And I became pregnant and had a child when I wasn't feeling old enough to deal with that. And then I began to feel I wasn't up to anything, really. I wasn't up to dealing with my life at all.
How long before you left?
I didn't leave Pete until the war was over. I didn't feel one could do that to somebody when they were fighting. It didn't seem fair or right to do it, but I think I sort of knew that I would have to.
And when you did leave, you left your daughter Nicola too?
I left him with her because I had no money, I had no job, I had no qualifications, I had half a novel. I just went with two suitcases of clothes, really.
Do you wonder now how you could have done that?
Well, how I could have left her...
Hmm.
I feel very bad about that. I saw her all the time. She was in London, and I saw her, well, all of Nanny's time off and holidays and things, I used to take her away. But I just felt she had a better life with him, you know. She had more things and more everything, really, and that's what one had to do.
Record number four.
Well, I regard Richard Strauss, as almost the last great composer, and I've only heard the whole of that opera, Ariadne, at Lyneborn once in my life, but I've never forgotten it. And I particularly love Zerbinetta, her immense aria, and it's a bit of this.
Küsste mir stirn und wangen, war ich von dem Mut gefangen.
part of Zerbinetta's aria from Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos, sung by Rita Streich with the Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So you left Peter Scott, Elizabeth Jane Hudd, with £10 and a suitcase and half a novel.
Yes.
But you very soon after that, I think, had that novel published into The Beautiful Visit.
About 2 years afterwards, I think.
I want to talk about what you did after that, but I just want to talk about a little bit more about this walking out on marriage, because you were to do it twice more after that. You
bit of a bolter.
Called yourself a bolter, yes. Do you think it takes courage to bolt?
Yes, I think it does. It always takes some courage to divest yourself of the status quo, I think, because one usually has a very great deal invested in that, whatever it's like, and the unknown is always a bit alarming.
But it also implies that you're not only unhappy with what you have, but that you believe you can have better, that there is better to be had. Is that? Did you have some kind of romantic ideal?
I think I don't know how to live with somebody unless I have very good feelings about them. And pretending that I have good feelings about them always seemed to me hopeless. So I suppose that when I was clear that nothing was moving in the right direction about a relationship, I did feel it was better to get out.
But you don't
think... It was a failure.
But you don't think also that you do have some kind of idealistic view of love?
I think probably then I did. I very much believed in love, and I believe...
Don't you anymore?
I believe very much in love now, but I think of it in a different way, I think. I think then I thought it was something that happened to you. And I think now, I think it's something which comes about out of who you are to begin with. I mean, I don't think I was fit for love, really. I mean, the main thing I think I had, which I think a lot of women have, is that the idea that they are somebody to whom things happen. They're not remotely in charge of any of it. It all just occurs.
So do you think that it happens to many people? Do you think many of us know what the love is that you would define as real love, as true love?
No, I think really good love, I'm not saying great love, is actually relatively rare. And I think people talk about it a lot. So the idea is that people think that everybody, because everybody could fall in love or have love, they think that everybody does. I think this is not true. I think it's a remarkable gift. And I think that if it's something you hold very dearly, then all you can do is get yourself ready to be that sort of person.
Next piece of music.
Well, Scarlatti is one of my very, very, very favourite composers, and this sonata is my favourite sonata, and one of the nicest things that ever happened to me was when Ralph Kirkpatrick played 16 Scarlatti sonatas in the Double Cube Room at Wilton, and as an encore, he played this B minor, which, because he knew it was my favourite.
Of Scarlatti's sonata in B minor, played by Vladimir Horowitz. You published your second and again very successful novel, The Long View, Elizabeth Jane Hudd, in 1956. It's a very grown-up book, actually, for a 32, 33-year-old.
Yes, I think it was quite grown-up. It also was a curious structure. I mean, I was writing it backwards, and all the time I was writing it, people told me you couldn't write a novel that way round.
It's again the story of a marriage.
It's a story of a marriage told backwards. And it seemed to me that you shouldn't use things like that, and gimmicks, or they become gimmicks if they're just used for their own sake. But in this particular case, it seemed to me the right way to find out about this marriage, to have it at its denouement and to work back to its conception.
There are those who say that your stepson, Martin Amis, has copied that technique in recent years.
Well, he certainly didn't copy. But I don't think that he knew that I'd done it. I didn't mention it at the time. I know that at the time everybody was talking about what a revolutionary thing it was. And I wondered mildly whether he'd ever heard of my book, but I don't think he had.
You, of course, his stepmother when he was really quite a small boy.
He was about 13, I think, when I first had him in my care.
Tell me about the difficulties of being a stepmother, because it must be very hard work again.
It's a bit of a no-win situation, I think, really, because, understandably, I think children are the people who are most damaged by broken marriages, and of course they are. And they are very likely, understandably, to be hostile to a new people or person who comes into their lives. Equally, I think it's very difficult to be a good stepmother because I think it's very difficult for them to trust you. I mean, Martin, in the end, did trust me about his education, and that worked. But
he's credited you.
He's been very generous
about getting him
to
Oxford.
Yes, he's very generous about that. But, I did want him to get there because he was exceptionally intelligent and exceptionally badly educated.
Do you still see Martin?
I do see him sometimes. I am in touch with him. Not very often. I'd like to see him more, really, but I'm very fond of him.
I want to ask you one thing about your marriage to Kingsley mm-hmm. Amis, the novelist. I know you don't like talking about it, but I think one thing is quite important. You've said before now, I've read it, that he made you laugh and that was a very important part.
Yes, he did.
Does that come into this definition, let me ask you, of love? I mean, do two people need to make each other laugh?
Well, I think it's a good thing if they do. I mean, I'm terribly in favour of there being jokes in life and jokes in books. And he made me laugh. I mean, he was a tremendously funny man, and he was very good at making one laugh. And for me, it's one of the biggest turn-ons there are, really. I think I'm always very, very attracted to people who can do that.
Record number 6.
Well, in our family, it was Kingsley, we always called J.S. Bach, Bach's father, because C.P. Bach was Bach, and that was a kind of joke. But I love him, and one of the things about him, the quality he has, it's very heroic music. And I think if I was alone on a desert island, one would need bracing up with a spot of heroism, you know?
Music by the son of J.S. Bach, part of the third movement of C.P.E. Bach's Concerto in D minor, played by the Slovak Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Bohdan Vachol. How much do you regret, Jane, all those years you subjugated your writing then to the marriage, all the years you spent cooking and tending husbands and families, and of course in Kingsley's case, of course, so that he could get on with his writing?
I think that had to be done. I think it's very difficult. I got awfully tired, and I think it's very difficult to write when you're tired. But I got very seized up at one point. I couldn't write at all. For about 2 years, I really wasn't able to produce anything. And I think it was partly because I was nursing my mother and also other people who died there. You know, there was a sort of collection of sadness and in the house. And I had no energy, really, for doing it. So I do regret it, but I don't think it's other people's fault. I think it was what I chose to do, and I think it's the wrong choice, but I chose it.
The Cazalets are now finished, and you're 72, but you're certainly not finished.
72 and a half.
Are there more novels in you yet, then, now that you've got the time and space to let them come out?
Yes, I've had three notions in my mind, and I think I've picked which one I'm going to do next.
So what do? Do you sit at a typewriter, or do you?
Yes, I sit at a typewriter, and then I only write one draft. I only write books. I can't cope with, you know, drafts and fiddling about, so I do it rather slowly to begin with.
So you don't rewrite, you don't tone it?
It just... I rewrote one bit of one novel once, because Kingsley thought I should, but I haven't otherwise.
And did it improve as a result?
Yeah, I never will know. He said it did.
But do your publishers accept them as they come now? I mean, are you big enough? They just say, well, if that's the way you want it, that's the way it is.
Yes, they don't. I have a wonderful editor who cheers me on, because I need a certain amount of straightforward flattery, I think, because I always write novels feeling I'm no good. And that if I ever was any good, I'm not any good anymore.
Let me ask you then a very difficult question, because you're the sort of character you say you are. I mean, do you think now that actually you are a good novelist?
I think, and possibly this is a good feeling to have, I think I could be better. I think it would be very uncomfortable if one felt, you know, if I had to put at the bottom of my school report, couldn't do better if you tried, you know. I'd like it not to be that way around.
Record number 7.
I love trumpets. I think that all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side makes me cry as a line out of Pilgrim's Progress. I love trumpets. I love Haydn because he loved Mozart and he was a lovely man, and I love his keyboard work too. But this concerto is tremendous, is full of gaiety and excitement, and I'm particularly fond of the last movement.
Part of the final movement of Haydn's Trumpet Concerto in E-flat, played by Håkon Hardenberger, with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. It sounds, Jane, as if you live on a rather idyllic desert island of your own in Suffolk, in a way, because you have a beautiful garden, a lovely house, you're expert at the garden, you have a wonderful, I'm told, well-used kitchen, because you're a good cook. Would you give it all up? Would you risk your peace and your quiet and your own domain to have another go at sharing your life?
I would give a great deal up in terms of time and how I spent my life, but I don't think I want to give up this place. And I think I'd want the person to like the place, but that's, you know, really becoming tremendously picky, because they might have a sweet little basement in Pimlico that they'd rather I was in.
But would the motive be, would it still be what you said you missed so much in your early life, to be appreciated, to be loved?
Yes, I don't know how it would be. It's very hard to imagine, isn't it, now, because I feel so old. But I think I would love to have a loving companion and somebody whose life I could be interested in and care for.
And do you think, when you look back across your life and the three marriages from which you bolted, that it's your fault, therefore, that you're not still married and that you don't have that companionship you so crave.
Yes, perhaps I didn't pick the right people, or they didn't pick me, or perhaps I wasn't a very, very lovable kind of person. I think that also might be true. I don't sort of shut the door on possibilities. There might be somebody who could make me want to go and live in a basement in Pimlico. Can't even rule that out, I suppose.
Last record.
I always feel very sad about this because I feel sad about Mozart's death and the manner of it. And this Requiem is so much connected with his death in a way. And also it's conducted by my very dear friend Jane Glover. We have many times when we talk about Mozart together because she loves him and knows him, of course, much better than me. And this is the Dies Irae, which is a marvellous bit from a great work.
The Dies Irae from Mozart's Requiem, performed by the BBC Singers and the London Mozart Players, conducted by Jane Glover. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Jane, which one?
I think I'd probably take the Requiem. But it's a very difficult choice, it really is.
And what about your book?
My book would be all the Scarlatti Sonatas, because my luxury would be a piano. And it's no good having a piano if you're me and you can't be aren't a composer without some music. And as there are 600 sonatas, it would take me a long time to learn them all.
Elizabeth Jane Howard, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.